morning edition of the Oregon State Senate Committee on Commerce. Today we're meeting this morning because we want to try to make sure we're facilitating some of the bills that have been given to us by the House. Today we're opening a public hearing on 2944A. And with that, I'm going to ask Bob Shifrak to please come forward. And I'm going to have Commissioner Dan Gardner join you. I understand he's on his way to the committees. But, Bob, I'll go ahead and let you get started. We only have an hour today, folks, and so based on the number of people that have signed up, and I assume there may be a few more people that are signing up, I'm going to give Mr. Shifrak and the commissioner no more than 10 minutes to do their presentation so we can go ahead and take as much testimony. We may need to limit the length of testimony. Let me make certain everyone understands today's only a public hearing. Because of that, the record will stay open and you can submit whatever written testimony you'd like. We also have a courtesy rule, I call it, that is anyone that has traveled over 100 miles, we will get you your testimony on the record, and we'll see how much time we have once we get through this process. With that, Mr. Shifrak, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shifrak. I'm Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I was hoping Jessica Adamson with AGC, who's also on her way, would join me, but I appreciate getting started.
Jessica's here. Ms. Adams, why don't you go ahead and come on up, and we'll get her up here, and then, like I said, I'll have Mr. Gardner join y'all as you're going through. Jessica, get your breath. We'll let Bob start off. We have about 10 minutes for y'all's presentation.
We're here today on House Bill 2944. This is the efforts of about a year and a half's work on an issue that is a problem ongoing in the state of Oregon today, and I'll try and tee up and frame for you the problem that we're bringing to the legislature. In 1959, Senator Mark then Governor Mark Hatfield signed Oregon's prevailing wage law, and it worked very well for many years. However, as things evolve in public contracting and other things, we've now moved into what are known as public-private partnerships, where public agencies may invest a lot of money in projects that they want to have built in partnership with private industry, which we support. However, what's occurred is, when does the amount of private public involvement, when would it trigger the prevailing wage law? And our statutes are not adequate. They talk about contracted for and carried on by. We don't really know what that means. There's not a lot of case law involved, and what we want to do with this legislation is have the legislature clearly define when or not prevailing wages, hello, Commissioner, when prevailing wages would be required on these type of projects. What we wanted to do is have a very, very bright line standard, and I think this bill does it. Passage of House Bill 2944, I've anecdotally told members of the Assembly, any one of us could then decide whether or not prevailing wages would apply on these types of projects or not. One of the things that spurred this, the commissioner formed a task force some time ago, about 18 months ago. We worked for about 8 months on that, on this issue. It really kind of fell apart. I took it on myself to try and work, first of all, with the affordable housing people on the issue, and then later on with the commercial folks. The problem you have is what this bill does is it splits this issue into two issues. You have the affordable housing issue, which you'll see exempts from prevailing wages those projects based at 60% of area median income for rental and 80% for home ownership. Conversely, on the commercial side or everything else, if there's more than $750,000 of public money invested in a project, then the prevailing wages would apply. So you'll have winners and losers. It is indeed a compromise on the issue. The Portland City Council became involved about 8 months ago, and ultimately the mayor asked the Portland Development Commission to form yet another group. We met three or four times at the Portland Development Commission and hammered out the agreement that is essentially what is in House Bill 2944 with little differences. And PDC and the Portland City Council did adopt by ordinance what they call their, I think it's the employment plan. And so they need to have the statutory underpinnings provided in House Bill 2944 to fully implement what they've already done by ordinance. I'll just briefly go through these handouts, and one of the things I want to do, Mr. Chairman, both for the committee and the public behind us, is, if I may, briefly go through what is the prevailing wage? What does it mean? Because very few people understand how it's arrived at, what it does. A lot of people don't know there are actually three prevailing wages that we use in Oregon. You have the Federal Davis-Bacon Act, used on federal projects. Then you have the Oregon State prevailing wage, which this is the latest edition of that. I'll talk about how that's arrived at. And then in your handout, the top one is the federal, we call them HUD rates, Federal Davis-Bacon Housing and Urban Development Rates. And these are what are used on residential projects. And they're much different from the commercial project wage rates. You'll note some of the wage rates, in particularly in outlying counties, aren't even at the state minimum wage as far as the HUD rates. The state prevailing wage rates are calculated annually by the Oregon Economic the Employment Department, a survey of over 5,000 contractors of the economists at the Employment Department, collate that, then put it together. The commissioner certifies the results. You can take a look at that. It's a mix of union and non-union rates, representing 14 different geographical areas around the state, and intended to say what indeed is the average wage in those communities. The next handout, just for your benefits, a memorandum of understanding we have with the affordable housing people to work cooperatively to see that fair wages, hours, and working conditions are maintained on the housing projects. A copy of ballot measure 12's election results. 1994, there was an effort to repeal our state prevailing wage law. It failed in all 36 counties. By a margin of 64%. I did some extensive polling of the issue. The 64% is still the number statewide of support for prevailing wage, but in fact in the Portland area the percentages actually went up. Here's a Cockshaw report. For 35 years, Peter Cockshaw wrote about the construction industry.
As I told you when we started, we're very limited on time, making sure we have enough people. I'm going to let you know you've got two other panelists there, and you have about 5 or 6 minutes for them to say what they need to say.
Just take a look at this. It's a close look at wage laws. One of the things you may hear today is these outlandish percentage increases if you use prevailing wage. This just points out that labor only represents about 20% of any construction project, so it's pretty hard to save 30% just on labor costs. An outstanding study that actually shows Oregon, Oregon is a high wage state, yet we're second lowest in the country on when you measure productivity on highway construction, and then some handouts talking about the benefits of prevailing wage to our society.
Stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors here in support of House Bill 2944 engrossed. This is an issue, as Mr. Shipwreck indicated, that we've been working a long time on and believe that this bill represents an important clarification and policy decision on when public private partnerships should be subject to prevailing wage. from the construction industry standpoint, this confusion over the current set of law, which wasn't designed to handle these kinds of projects, never even when it was done and built, this law never contemplated these projects because they, quite frankly, didn't exist. And in today's environment, they're existing more and more often, and the public participation is becoming very involved in order to make these projects go. However, from our standpoint, this uncertainty about when it applies and when it doesn't apply, it slows the project down. There's increased litigation. There's back and forth between the Bureau and the agency. And that slow process means that projects take longer to get off the ground. And quite frankly, increases in material costs drive the project costs higher in some cases because of the delay than even perhaps the cost of prevailing wage. So it is a real impact on the cost of development. It's a real impact in uncertainty. And when these projects begin, if there isn't a clear answer about whether it's subject or not, it leaves the contractor in a very difficult position because we don't know, are we subject or are we not? And at the end of the day, if we are, we're in part liable for those increased wages. And even if we've been paying scale, it's a cause of litigation and issues for contractors, which is unfortunate and unnecessary from our perspective, which is why this bill that clarifies and creates a compromise of when it should be subject and when it shouldn't is important for development interests. It's important for contracting interests. It also, this bill makes important steps to clarify some of what aren't public funds. It clarifies that land sold at fair market value is not considered to be public funds, and this is important because there are transactions between private development and the public that are done straight up, and those shouldn't count as public funds when you make a legitimate purchase. Additionally, it clarifies that tax credits and abatements, which aren't today considered to be public funds, it puts that in statute. So the concern, the issues raised over that issue are put to bed. They are not considered through this bill. It is very clear that those are not public funds. So the additional clarification, the additional certainty will help promote additional projects. It sets the rules of the game so developers, private owners, public owners know going in what the rules will be. It helps make a decision more quickly about what projects will happen and on what schedule, and that's good for workers, it's good for contractors, and we think it's good for the public. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 2944. As Mr. Shipwreck said, I held an 8.5-month task force on this issue. It's become an increasing issue. I don't think the law ever anticipated public-private partnerships, nor the volume with which they would balloon over the last 10 years. The first case of public-private partnerships that came to the Bureau was under my predecessor, Jack Roberts, when the Salem Carousel Project came along. And the Bureau has ruled consistently on that when there is, in fact, a contract for construction and public funds involved in it. Litigation has absolutely escalated over the last several years, and several cases are still working their way through the courts. But to put this in perspective, what is prevailing wage really about? It's really about paying the area community standard practices wages and benefits for a particular craft of what your local people in your community are over 50% earning in wages and benefits. It's saying that government, when it's using public funds, taxpayer dollars, to build in part or in full a project, that we're not going to reduce the wages and benefits of our local workers. You're going to have them compete on a different basis than that of labor. In most cases we see at the Bureau, what we find is where the so-called savings is in not paying health care and retirement to workers. And that's over 65% in most cases of what the difference is. To put it also in perspective, there's 31 other states that have a Little Davis-Bacon Act or a Prevailing Wage Act. Not one of them distinguish a difference between public-private partnerships and a what you would consider a standard prevailing wage project, such as a school, road, or a bridge. They all treat them equally as exactly the same thing. And they all have varying thresholds, anywhere from a dollar, which eight states have. At the point you put one government dollar in, it is a prevailing wage project, and prevailing wages are paid from that point on, no matter how much the government puts in or private entities do. The highest threshold in the nation is $500,000. What this bill would do is say for public-private partnerships alone, the threshold would be $750,000, $250,000 higher than the highest threshold in the nation. It is a compromise bill. It is a fair bill. It also exempts, affordable housing at the lowest end of the affordable housing spectrum. It actually does brighten and clear the line. I know when I came in, one of the biggest complaints contractors and local governments had is they didn't know when they were tripping over the line. What we attempted to do was turn the agency into a predetermination agency, because I didn't think it was fair for you to find out in the middle or the end of a project suddenly your prevailing wage. We've gone from doing about one or two predeterminations a year to doing over 100 a year. This would actually brighten the line where we wouldn't have to do so many predeterminations, where the average person could sit there and go, okay, I know where the line is. We know when we're tripping over it. And there wouldn't be the need for those number of predeterminations. It's a compromise bill. I know there's other amendments that will be offered. I've heard there's even an amendment perhaps about conduit financing. I can tell you that the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee took up that issue for over a year and a half. The current rules we have are completely fair and establish a bright line in that area, and I'd be happy to comment on any other amendments that may come along.
All right, thank you. We're going to have a work session, and at that point we may need you to come back regarding whatever amendments we have before us and what we're willing to do. I'm going to ask if there's questions for this panel. I also want to caution everyone. I have 23 other people who want to be testifying today, 23. And so that's less than 2 minutes a person. I'm going to go for 2 minutes, but I'm going to be asking for those who are coming up in little groups to not repeat each other. We want to make sure everyone has an opportunity. We do need to be shutting down close to 8:30, if not at 8:30, because of other commitments that all of us have. So any questions, Senator Gordley?
Thank you for the commissioner, and good morning. Would you please name the minority organizations that you consulted and or that were involved in the 8.5-month task force?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I had worked with AWAMI, and we had talked with them quite a bit about the task force. On the task force, we had Keith Edwards on the task force. We also had Kenny Carr of Carr Construction Company on the task force. And we worked with every organization that wished to work with us.
Sam Brooks.
Oh, and Sam Brooks. I'm sorry. Sam Brooks was on the...
And is there agreement among those that you are referencing with the measure before us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't know that there's agreement within those groups. There is a varying opinion within some of those groups. I can tell you that the comments out of Kenny Carr with Carr Construction Company, his comments on the task force can simply be paraphrased as saying, if people don't want to pay prevailing wage, don't take the government money, was what he consistently said on the group.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. My first panel after this one is Kathleen Chavez, Terry Axness, and Dan Moore. Senator Ferrioli, I understand that you wanted to also give comment with these individuals. Why don't we come up, if you'll come on up, let's see if we can get a fourth chair, and that way we'll be all together.
I'm Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Shads, and I'm the fundraiser for the Crossroads Carnegie Arts and Cultural Center project in Baker City. I'm testifying on behalf of all of us and in support of House Bill 2944-12, which is a very narrowly defined amendment that would only serve to exempt this one project. The purpose of the amendment is to correct a situation that has recently been brought to our attention. Crossroads Art Center is a small, 44-year-old nonprofit, 501c3, with an annual budget of only $75,000. It's run by more than 100 volunteers and one part-time director and serves our remote Eastern Oregon communities and surrounding regions. In 2000, the city of Baker City, Crossroads began a conversation about Crossroads using the abandoned Carnegie Library building to become its permanent home. From the beginning, the city told Crossroads that renovating the Carnegie building would have to be a Crossroads project and the city would not be involved. The city gave Crossroads a lease with an indefinite number of 30-year renewal periods, and it didn't contain any construction language. Crossroads took that lease and added the construction language to guarantee it had permission to make the renovations. In 2002, the city, Crossroads, and the general contractor proceeded with the understanding that it was not a prevailing wage project after the city attorney had studied the law as it was stated at the time. The project has always been managed as a Crossroads project with no city involvement. This year's requirement for final grant to complete the project, Crossroads submitted documentation to Boley. And in February 2007, Boley informed us that the project qualified as a prevailing wage job. Crossroads, Baker City, and the general contractor all respect Boley's mission. We have no quarrel with Boley, and we can understand how they reached this interpretation. We have raised more than $1 million from our local community and fundraising sources to complete the project. As a small rural community, we have exhausted all of our revenue resources, and if the amendment before you does not pass, the -12 amendment, the project will not be completed as planned. With this amendment, we can ask for the grant funds that have been restricted to finish the project. When completed, the project will give Crossroads the sustainability to broaden its programs to benefit our entire community. We focus mainly on programs for children who are from underprivileged and at-risk families. It's an integral part of the economic development package for Baker. We're asking for your support of House Bill 2944-12, a very narrowly constructed amendment that exempts only this project and allows Crossroads Art Center to complete its mission to create opportunities for our entire community to be engaged, inspired, and transformed by the arts through participation in classes, workshops, exhibits, mentorships, and partnerships, to be a welcoming place where people meet and the arts speak. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Chavez, thank you very much. And I should have told you that since you had written testimony, it wasn't necessary for you to read it in the record.
Okay.
If y'all want to, you have more time since you said you were going to speak for all of them. And I know Senator Farioli wants to also stand in support of your amendment. Let me ask if there's any questions for the panelists that are before us. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State Senator Ted Farioli, representing District 30, of which Baker County is part. This is a project I think you'd all enjoy being invited to the ribbon cutting, because it really does make art a focal point for economic sustainability for the community. It's a great idea. This is a perfect example of an unintended consequence. As you heard, the contractor, the city, the Arts Council, none of them argue with the purpose of prevailing wage issues. It's simply that they got an opinion later in the project maybe than could have happened. And I've discussed this issue with Dan Gardner. Boley has a consultative mission, and they try to get ahead of these projects and freely admit sometimes the question comes later than it ought to. That's what happened here. The problem is that there is an interpretation that's been appealed and reaffirmed that this is a prevailing wage project. It would add $300,000 to the already $1 million project, and the resources just don't exist in the community. So to say, you know, this project, gee, we just need an angel, or, you know, call the cavalry, they'll ride over the hill and save the project, probably isn't going to happen. If this amendment isn't adopted, you've heard folks from the project testify. testify that they're up against the wall. So I would hope that the committee in its wisdom could see that this is a perfect object lesson to hold up to other communities to say, don't get in this pickle. Get your consultations from Boley early. Get the questions answered. Use those consultative services to keep these interpretations from happening. And the reason they're in this mess is there's one sentence in the lease that talks about connecting this project with the permission that was needed to make sure that they could go ahead and do the contracting. And that is the nexus that causes this to be a public-private partnership. That is also the nexus that causes the Boley interpretation, that it's a prevailing wage project. We've asked if they can go back and rewrite the lease. It won't matter, you know, because that was the premise under which the project went forward. We've taken great pains to draft 13 lines that can apply nowhere else on earth but to this project, and what it does is exempt this project from prevailing wage limitations and requirements, and it will guarantee the completion of the project. So there you have it, colleagues. It's a very narrow issue. We need a solution, and I hope the committee can see that to remove this obstacle won't overturn the principle, but it will, in fact, help other people understand that the consultative services offered by Boley have great value. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? I also want to thank you and your constituents for coming over from Baker City to give your testimony today. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, our next group of individuals I'm going to call up is going to be Janet Young, Gwen Griffith, and Randy Tucker. And as I mentioned to the last panel, if you have written testimony, there's no reason to read it into the record. We will look at that. We are more interested in hearing from you, from your heart, as to the issues and maybe summarizing high points that you want to make sure that we focus on. And if you're ready to start.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Janet Young. I'm the Economic Development Manager for the City of Gresham, also manage the Urban Renewal Agency in Gresham. In 2003, the city residents of Gresham adopted an urban renewal agency in the Rockwood portion of the city of Gresham. And for those of you who are familiar with that, it is on the west side of the city in an area that is really severely distressed, has had a lot of increasing poverty and increasing social problems in that part of the city. And this urban renewal agency was seen as one of the real viable possibilities of helping really make a difference and turn around that area. And shortly after the Urban Renewal Agency was created, well before we really had any funds in the bank, there became an opportunity to acquire what had then been an abandoned Fred Meyer store right in the center in a real catalytic part of the Rockwood community. So the Urban Renewal Agency borrowed $8 million to acquire this piece, 6.5 acres, and is really seen to be a catalyst or transformative project for the community of Rockwood as part of the city of Gresham. But it does have severe problems in the area. There are low rents in the area. There are social problems that make it a real challenge to find a developer to come into this project, be able to allow the Urban Renewal Agency to sell the project to somebody who can create a project that really will transform that community. There is the ability now for the market to create a big box retail store with a sea of surface parking. We have heard over and over again from members of that community that that's not what they want. They want something that really will turn this place around and be the beginning of a creative and wonderful start, new start for this area of Rockwood that has a rich history. It is one of the most ethnically diverse parts of our city and has a great potential in many ways, but a very tough market. So right now, the Urban Renewal Agency is looking at all sorts of possibilities for allowing us to get a developer into that project. We will sell the project to a developer, but we very well may need to sell the project for way less than market value in order to get a project that really will turn this area around. this bill has the potential to raise the costs and make it even more difficult for the project to occur. Consequently, the City of Gresham opposes the passage of House Bill 2944 and encourages you not to approve this bill and not to impose prevailing wages on these projects that are really looking at putting in public money to do something that the private marketplace cannot do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Griffith. Ms. Young, excuse me. Ms. Griffith?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gwen Griffith. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Facilities Authority, known as OFA, which is your state agency that facilitates the issuance of tax-exempt conduit revenue bonds for nonprofits throughout the state. OFA's mission is to assist nonprofits in obtaining the lower cost bond financing that is available to them because of federal rules. Conduit financing does not involve taxpayer dollars. When a nonprofit comes to us, they pay all of the cost of issuance of their bonds, and people from the public and banks and institutions are providing the money. This is not taxpayer dollars that are funding any kind of construction by a nonprofit. Most important, I suppose, is that conduit revenue bonds do not result in the state of Oregon being on the hook. If there is a default, heaven forbid, it is the problem of the borrower, not the state of Oregon. So conduit revenue bonds, like OFAs, we believe are not the kind of project that this bill is intended or should apply to. It certainly is not the kind of public-private partnership that we've heard about this morning. OFA has another concern with this bill. Traditionally, OFA has supported projects in the $30 million range, which I think is large. The cost of issuance has not been such that small nonprofits can benefit from OFA. This year, OFA has started the process of finding ways to make tax-exempt financing available to smaller nonprofits. And we've embarked upon what we call the Express Bond Project. These are really low-cost bonds that are suitable for $1 million or $2 or $5 million of financing. What the nonprofit does is go to its local bank and get a real estate loan. That's a private transaction. We trade it out for a bond, and then it becomes a tax-exempt bond. As I travel around the state and talk to nonprofits, they do not view this as the kind of public-private partnership that should be subject to prevailing wages. They're very concerned about the cost of that, particularly the cost of compliance with prevailing wages.
I need you to wrap up if you could.
Yes. So OFA does not object to prevailing wages in the public sphere. However, we're looking for a happy place, and I understand there's some amendments that may get us there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tucker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. With your just point of information, Mr. Morihara signed up with me, and he's probably next on the list anyway, but I just wanted to note that. I have submitted some relatively lengthy written testimony because our concerns about this bill, the Metro Council's concerns about this bill, are not what you would instantly think of. However, Ms. Young from the City of Gresham has provided a case study that is very analogous to the concerns that we have. I should say at the outset, the Metro Council fully supports requiring public entities to pay a prevailing wage for the construction of public works. But the Council opposes this bill in its current form because it goes beyond that very important imperative. Just try to summarize briefly. As you know, the Metro Council is charged with managing the Portland region's growth and development in a way that protects the region's quality of life now and for future generations. The Council has done that in the past using regulatory tools to a great extent, the urban growth boundary, etc., but it's become clear that you can stop bad things from happening through regulation, but you can't make good things happen through regulation. So the Council has increasingly move toward trying to find ways to leverage our limited public resources in a way that can stimulate the kind of private investment that improves our communities and our economy. One of the ways that we do that is through the transit-oriented development program that we have at Metro. And the intent of that program is to stimulate key investments and developments in the centers that have been designated in the Metro region's long-range plan, the 2040 growth concept. I've provided a one-pager about the centers program, what the benefits are of developing in centers. If we fail with our centers work, which is a key strategy for avoiding sprawl, the default is to have to expand the urban growth boundary more rapidly than would otherwise be necessary or desirable. But the development of centers that work often involves costs that are higher than sort of the typical default development scenario, and that's where our transit-oriented development program, or our TOD program, comes in.
Mr. Tucker, I need your finish up.
Okay. Let me just, you can read the testimony. I've attached a possible amendment. If you look at the third page of the testimony, suggest a couple of possible changes to the bill, and then after that I've attached an amendment that was provided in the House, as well as a slight modification to that amendment. We're in the location business in this program. We buy land and try to convey it to developers in a fashion that allows the developments to go forward economically that we're working on. And there is no way under the thresholds in this bill that we can continue to do that. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Morehaw, please come up. And then I'm also going to ask, and it's Dr. Gary, I'm not sure if it's Andine or Anseline.
Andine.
And then Kevin Mannix.
Should I stop?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Hiroshi Morihara. I'm a construction business owner, and I'm a very active in civic activities, especially as related to economic development. But today, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 2944. I'd like to speak as a business owner. As you may be aware, Oregon has a fantastic reputation across the nation as a lover of green practices. And because of this reputation, I think it's natural that the metro bond measure of 227.4 million dollars for preservation of nature passed, and so I think we are doing a really great job preserving the nature. But what is happening is that in the next 15 to 20 years, 1 million people will be moving into Metro, and if we keep going with business as usual, this quality of life will be destroyed fairly quickly. In fact, Portland Business Alliance, Port of Portland, and other entities did a study and reported in December of 2005, which shows that just the transportation congestion as we move in this current fashion will cost the business $844 million a year, and the commuters will spend 28 hours more per year in commuting. So we need to do something to make sure that our quality of life is preserved. And I think we have a great plan. Actually, Metro is leading this plan, and I really endorse this plan, which is called Get Centered. And that this project is that we want to have high-density development in city, village, and transit centers, so that we don't have an urban sprawl like we have in Los Angeles. And so we have to make sure that not only preserving the nature, but this guest standard project get traction so that we don't have ugly urban sprawl. Now, what is happening
Mr.
is
Hara,
that...
I need you to summarize your closing.
We are developing with Metro two condo towers in the Gresham's civic neighborhood. And because of the high density requirement, we need underground parking. So we are hoping that Metro subsidize some of the underground parking space, because once you build a high rise, construction costs will go up between 20% and 40%, so you need some subsidy. And if House Measure 2944 passes, there may be a potential increase in labor wages, but the time required to do the paperwork and some dispute on wages, which may delay construction costs. So chances are this development will not happen. And we will be developing elsewhere, because this land will stay vacant because it will not be economically feasible. So I urge you to reject this bill so that the center will get attraction, so that we can continue to enjoy beautiful nature we all love. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Dr. Andine.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. I'm Gary Andine, Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association, representing all 19 of Oregon's nonprofit regionally accredited colleges and universities. We're here to ask that you consider, I believe, dash 13 amendments, which would exclude Oregon Facility Authority and revenue bond financing for nonprofits. As you have already heard from Ms. Griffith, this really isn't private, really isn't public money that we're talking about. And in the case of my institutions, we've done over $250 million of these kinds of conduit bond financing in the last 4 years. If we have to abide by all the BOLI restrictions, this would probably drive our costs up somewhere between 6% and 10%. This is one of the important ways that we have to keep our tuitions down, and we'd like to continue doing that. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see if I can get myself.
Kevin? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Mannix, a former legislator. I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem. I'm here today on my own behalf and on behalf of the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce. We ask you to, one, send this bill to an interim task group or interim legislative group, not a commissioner's group, but a legislative group for substantial reworking. We think that's the best solution to the problems you're going to have in front of you today with very short time. But absent that, I ask you to ask, where is Victor Merced, the Director of Housing and Community Services, and what happened to the amendments that he offered in the House to help with affordable housing? They're not in this bill, but he isn't here either, and I invite members of the committee to maybe have private conversations and find out what happened with the agency directors who are not in this room today. Why is it that the Labor Commissioner becomes the czar of prevailing wage so that he has his fingers in every public service project in this state? You need to consider this. The Senate needs to give careful consideration to what's happening in this bill. The Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Transportation, where are they today? What about their projects? What about housing? All of those things need to be considered, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee. But let me ask you to look at this bill then and say, if you can't consider those things, if time is short, why is there an emergency clause in this bill? Why is it going in effect in 6 weeks? If so, where are the proposed rules? Why are we giving the Commissioner of Labor and Industries, for the first time in Oregon history, broad-based authority to write all the rules with no agency consultation in here from any of the people that are doing these projects? That's what's in this bill. If you choose to go ahead with this bill, I urge you to do this. One, delete the emergency clause. Make this bill go through the regular process and go into effect January 1. Two, put in a sunset clause. December 31, 2011, that'll allow two legislative sessions to go back and take a look at what has happened. The commissioner is saying with this bill, trust me, I want a bright line, but I want to hold the brush, and I want to hold the bucket, and I want to draw the line through my rulemaking authority. Okay? Give him two sessions and let him come back, and we'll see whether or not it's been done right. That way, you can look at all the issues that may be confronting you with this legislation and have a chance to do the right thing. I recognize there's pressure to deal with the public-private partnerships. I invite you to do what you can, but I ask you to build some buffers into this process. One last thing, Mr. Chairman. Page 3 of the bill, that phrase, at fair market value, as to sale of land to private entity, you can run a lot of horses through that barn door. That phrase should be taken out of this bill, because everyone debates what fair market value means if you're exempting something. If it's a sale of land, leave it alone. Let the agency make the decision as to whether or not they did the right thing.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You're the first one, Mr. Mannix, to say maybe we should do a legislative task force in the interim on this, and I'm inferring from that that maybe you see some role for an expansion of the prevailing wage rules. You just don't see it in this bill. Am I inferring correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dovakian, absolutely. We do have new issue areas that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed comprehensively.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, I have a panel here that's all in one block. It's Steve Wrinkle, Dennis Russell, and it's either Doug Goh or Coe. And gentlemen, I'm assuming since you're all in the same block, you're all coming from the same group, or not, because there's no identification as to who you represent or whatever. But I'm going to ask you, if you're all together, to not tell us three times the same thing.
Chair Brozanski, I'm Steve Wrinkle, and we are not all from the same group.
Okay.
I am the General Counsel for Pacific Retirement Services, which is located at 1200 Miramar, Medford, Oregon, 97504. PRS is a 501c3 tax-exempt Oregon nonprofit corporation that owns and operates a number of senior living facilities throughout Oregon as well as in other states. We have the concerns that have been expressed by others with respect to the effect that House Bill 2944 would have with regard to conduit revenue bond financings. The facilities that we own and operate are constructed almost entirely through the use of conduit revenue bonds. The financial margins that exist for these projects are typically very, very thin. And consequently, we think this would have a dramatic impact upon our operations. Pacific Retirement Services owns the facility in Medford known as the Rogue Valley Manor. This summer or fall, we hope to be constructing a significant expansion of our health care center. We have, in anticipation of this hearing, contacted our contractors who have estimated that we will be looking at an approximate 30% increase in the labor component of those projects if House Bill 2944 is enacted. Likewise, a couple of years ago, we made a substantial remodel and renovation of our Cascade Manor facility located in Eugene. Senator, Chair Brozanski, I think that's within your district. That was an $18 million project. And in going back and looking at that, we estimate that would have resulted in an increase of $3.2 million to the project cost if House Bill 2944 in its current form were in existence then.
Mr. Wrinkle, you've gone over 2 minutes. I've got a number of people that still need to go, and I've got to give up this room at 8:30.
Thank you.
Another committee coming in.
Chair Brozanski, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Russell, and I'm the chair of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, and I'm also the executive director for a relatively small not-for-profit retirement community in Newburgh, Oregon. And you've got my testimony, and so I won't, you know, walk through that. I think you've got some Dash 13 amendments that are circulating that will actually address this issue for us as well. I can just tell you, we just completed a project. We've been in the Newburgh community for 45 years. And in fact, Senator Gorley and I have had a couple of conversations this year about bringing more funds into the senior Medicaid program and ways to help those folks that our missions would really require us to serve and the people on the fringes. And we just completed a project that expanded our services, expanded our health care center and our outreach into the community. And we used tax-exempt bond financing and a local hospital authority to secure those bonds. And in our case, we actually applied and did a pretty significant analysis, and it was only 6.8% increase, which to many people, 6.8% construction contract, I think in my testimony, it's got the specific numbers. It was about $768,000 of increased cost to our project. That might not seem like a lot. It's significant to a relatively small not-for-profit in Newburgh, Oregon, given our 19,000-person population and given the expansion of our ministry. And so the Dash 13 amendments will help us in terms of this not being treated as a publicly financed, because it's the premise that we're coming from, that it isn't public funds. And so we are here really to testify, and my written testimony will walk you through that in opposition of the bill as written, but we would support and consider the Dash 13 amendments to help solve this particular issue. You heard earlier about a very small, narrow project in Baker City, which is, again, rural. We have many rural not-for-profit providers, small not-for-profits that you also heard from the state agency that places these conduit bonds, that would be adversely affected as a result of the way this current bill is written. So we would hope that you would strongly look at the Dash 13 amendments that helps our small not-for-profit and rural providers and deal with the issues before you, but not just the state conduit bonds, but also our local conduit bonds. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Doug Goh. I'm a bond lawyer with the law firm of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. And I've had the honor and privilege of serving as bond counsel for more than 25 years to Oregon's conduit revenue bond agencies. The legislature has had conduit financing since the 1970s. It covers, in addition to the senior living projects that you just heard about, nonprofit hospitals, small issue manufacturing companies, usually in the $2 to $5 million range. It also covers solid waste projects for landfills. And you also heard about nonprofit higher education institutions. I'm here to support the Dash 13 amendments as well. It's important that those apply both to, as they do currently drafted, both to local issuers, that is local hospital authorities, local cities and counties, as well as the state Oregon Facilities Authority. I'm also here, Chair, to advocate that the current bill does not broadly enough define affordable housing. The federal, imposes a new test. Federal law for many years has defined a different test for affordable housing. I will submit for the record an amendment to the bill that would use the federal test, because I think the current test may work for some metro projects, but what we have consistently heard from our clients, affordable housing clients outside the metropolitan area, outside the Willamette Valley, is that the test that has been imposed in the bill is not broad enough to cover projects on the coast, projects in eastern and central Oregon, and would appreciate the committee's consideration of those amendments.
Thank you. Mr. Goh, if you can get us that amendment or the language that you are suggesting sooner than later.
We'll get it to you. I've got a draft with me, and we'll be happy to do that, Chair.
All right. Thank you. We're not going to take any questions. We've got 4 minutes before another committee is coming in here. I got six other people, if not more, that are here. Some of the individuals are not going to be able to testify today, but Mr. Posey, I'm going to have you please come up. And Ms. Richardson, I know that you had something that you needed to get on the record as to the issues with the state treasurer. And Mr. is it Jackley? And I'm going to ask you again, if you have written testimony, please don't read that. If you can summarize, the less time you take, the more people we can get. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley with the Portland Development Commission. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. Our Board of Commissioners recently adopted a construction wage policy for Portland that has many elements similar to those in the bill. With respect to the dollar thresholds, the definition of public resources, and the drawing of a bright line as to the applicability to public-private projects, our board is supportive. But there's one major difference, and that's that is this. Both the bill and the PDC construction wage policy would result in a considerable expansion of prevailing wage. But it's only the PDC policy that includes a commensurate expansion of opportunities for women and the minority community to participate in the benefits of these higher-paying family wage jobs. The PDC policy requires a workforce diversity agreement with the parties who would participate in the higher wages, annual affirmative action reports from union and non-union sources of labor, liquidated damages against developers and general contractors who fail to comply with our project apprenticeship agreements and other processes, and project-specific agreements on workforce diversity that take into account local capacity and specific projects. We feel that the financial and the mechanical provisions of this bill are sound. We would like to see provisions that include opportunities for women and minorities to participate. In the end, all of the stakeholders that we worked with, including organized labor, publicly supported our construction wage policy that included provisions for diversity, accountability, and we don't see any reason why the same thing can't be done with this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Posey?
Yes, my name is James Posey. I'm the president of NAMCO, National Association of Minority Contractors. I'm a local Portland area small contractor. And I would reserve my comments to concur with what Mr. Jackley has said. And I don't often find myself in agreement with Kevin Mannix, but I would also like to sign on to his statements about having accountability. Let me just say, if you will look just through the thread of the testimony here, you will find certain issues. One is around poor people, poverty, seniors, and that this bill would discourage participation by those who are less able to participate in the system. So there's a thread through the testimony that you see here. The issue around minorities and contractors trying to get into the system, you know, as we began to talk about situations in which the government is involved and the private sector is involved, we are beginning to exclude young people who don't have a chance, who can't get into the system, where you have a autonomy and you have a little discretion. These kinds of programs begin to impinge upon that kind of discretion. Let me just say this also. I'm concerned about the discriminatory results. Not intent, but the results. And I'm hoping that by virtue of looking at this bill in a more comprehensive way, you all can define what the impact is going to have on those less able to get into this system and participate economically. I'll reserve my comments. Thank you very much.
Posey, thank you very much. And for those, we're going to have Ms. Richardson's going to conclude. She has less than a minute to speak. The others that did not get to speak, I tried to get individuals that are either lobbyists or people that are represented by lobbyists so we can make sure your message can get around to the committee. Apologize, we only had an hour today. Ms. Richardson, please go.
For the record, Christopher Richardson, Chief of Staff of State Treasurer Randall Edwards, and I will come back and talk with you when you consider amendments before you, but I do want to say that the Treasurer does support a bright line bill regarding prevailing wage. However, as you've heard in prior testimony, public-private partnerships, we issue all the bonds for the state, and that includes a number of the conduit loan program and other loan programs that are to private entities. This would reach in and change those to a different status than they've had before. That creates a lot of practical problems by turning financing agreements into de facto contracts for public works. There are timing issues with this bill right now as well. You have an amendment to address that are absolutely crucial. We are supportive of the Dash 13s. We've seen those. We have some language there before you that is very similar to that we're happy to consider, too, and we'll come back and talk to you during the work session.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, I apologize for those who were not able to be here today, but remember the record is open. If you have written testimony or if you want to see us individually, please do so. We're now adjourned.
Nice seeing you again. I'm really glad you're here.